This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. JNSPG staff will read synopses of articles which have been published online this week. The full text versions of these articles can be found in the online and print versions of the journal.
Hello and welcome to the Journal of Neurosurgery podcast for January 29th, 2010. I'm Paul Pugh and I'll be reading synopses of one laboratory investigation, three clinical articles, and one case report, which were published online today by the Journal of Neurosurgery. We start this week's podcast with a laboratory investigation. It is titled Compression of the Cervical Internal Carotid Artery by the Stylopharyngeus Muscle, an anatomical study with potential clinical significance. It was written by R. Shane Tubbs and co-workers. In Eagle syndrome, an elongated styloid process can impinge on the internal carotid artery, ICA, resulting in pain or cerebral ischemia. Compression by muscles extending from the styloid process in the absence of an elongated process has not been explored. To elucidate such a relationship, the dissection of the skull base was performed in human cadavers. Compression of the ICA by the stylopharyngeus muscle was found in 12.5% of the specimens. Effacement of the lumen of the ICA by the stylopharyngeus ranged from approximately 30 to 50%. Such compression was increased by approximately 25% with ipsilateral rotation of the head. Based on this study, a subset of patients with occlusion of the cervical ICA but without elongation of the styloid process should be included within the definition of Eagle syndrome. The authors believe that standard surgical treatments for Eagle syndrome would be adequate in treating symptomatic compression by the stylopharyngeus because this muscle would be made lax following such procedures. Plain radiographs would probably show negative results in symptomatic patients because the styloid process was not elongated in any specimen in the current study. Such compression may only be appreciated on CT angiography or conventional angiography at the level medial and distal to the styloid process and may occur only with head rotation. The first clinical article this week is titled Safety of Carotid Endarterectomy While on Clopidogrel. It was written by Scott Waite and colleagues. Carotid endarterectomy is one of the most common surgical procedures performed worldwide. In a study comprising almost 200 patients undergoing carotid endarterectomy, the authors did not find any adverse effects with the continued use of clopidogrel. There was no additional morbidity or death among patients taking clopidogrel in the last week before surgery. The risks associated with discontinuing clopidogrel include perioperative stroke and myocardial infarction. In a population of patients likely to have multiple vasculopathies, the authors believe that these are graver risks than a re-exploration for hematoma. Therefore, they recommend the continuation of clopidogrel throughout the perioperative period in patients undergoing carotid endarterectomy. The next clinical article is written by Ruko Shamoon and co-authors. It is titled, Role of Extracellular Glutamate Measured by Cerebral Microdialysis in Severe Traumatic Brain Injury. Recent studies have suggested that glutamate plays a role in the pathophysiology of traumatic brain injury. Glutamate, the predominant excitatory neurotransmitter, is normally present in the intracellular space. However, it can be toxic to neurons when present in large amounts in the extracellular compartment. This phenomenon has been referred to as excitotoxicity. Using microdialysis, the authors measured the extracellular glutamate levels in 165 patients with traumatic brain injury and evaluated their prognostic value. Patients received standard care. Intracranial pressure and brain tissue oxygenation were monitored and a microdialysis catheter was placed for the measurement of extracellular glutamate levels. The authors identified two main patterns of extracellular glutamate concentrations. In some patients, the glutamate levels normalized over a few days, whereas in others, extracellular glutamate tended to increase or remain abnormally elevated. There was a significantly lower mortality rate and an increased chance of functional recovery among patients whose glutamate levels normalized. Data in the study showed that extracellular glutamate levels correlate with patient outcome in traumatic brain injury. This clinical article is titled Transfusions and Long-Term Functional Outcomes in Traumatic Brain Injury. It was written by Matthew Warner and colleagues. Most clinicians agree that aggressive red blood cell transfusions in the critically ill often do more harm than good. However, traumatic brain injury, or TBI, is a unique subtype of critical illness. As the brain is particularly sensitive to hypoperfusion and hypoxia, maintaining a normal hematocrit may be necessary to ensure sufficient cerebral oxygenation after a traumatic insult. In theory, this seems logical. However, no one truly knows whether transfusions benefit patients with TBI, and there is much debate among neurosurgeons and neurointensivists about who should be transfused and at what critical hematocrit level. The goal of the author's study was to determine the relationship between transfusions and long-term patient outcomes. They focused on TBI patients with moderate anemia, as the decision whether to perform a transfusion is most controversial for this group of patients. The authors evaluated the outcomes for 292 patients over a 2-year period. Roughly half of those moderately anemic patients underwent transfusions, the other half did not. At 6 months post-injury, the patients who had received transfusions had substantially worse outcomes than those who had not. This provides evidence that aggressive transfusions may be harmful to patients with TBI, and transfusion volume should be minimized when possible. Yoshi Nonaka and colleagues wrote the following case report, which is titled Unilateral Hypoglossal Nerve Palsy Caused by an Intraneural Ganglion Cyst. The authors present an extremely rare case of unilateral hypoglossal nerve palsy caused by an intraneural ganglion cyst in over 5,000 cases of skull-based surgeries performed by the senior author. This is the first case of intracranial intraneural ganglion cyst. 3 similar cases have been reported with pathological classification that are still under consideration. 1 case was classified as an intraneural ganglion cyst, and 2 cases were classified as atlanto-occipital joint synovial cysts. The authors described the case of a 54-year-old man who presented with a 7-year history of left-sided tongue atrophy, rapidly increasing hoarseness, and a swallowing disturbance. Imaging demonstrated a 15-millimeter mass adjacent to the left side of the medulla. The mass compressed the medulla and extended into the left hypoglossal canal. Preoperatively, it was presumed to be a chordoma or hypoglossal neuroma, but there was no gadolinium enhancement on imaging. Intraoperatively, the tumor was white, transparent, and appeared as multilocutated cysts that originated from the full width of the left hypoglossal nerve. This gelatinous tumor, which had the appearance of a chordoma, was histopathologically diagnosed as an intraneural ganglion cyst.
Thank you for listening. To read all the articles published by the JNSPG this week, or to listen to more podcasts from the Journal of Neurosurgery or Neurosurgical Focus, please visit us at thejns.org.